This morning, our speaker is Rabbi Rami Shapiro. Rabbi Rami was ordained as a Reform rabbi in 1981, and he earned a doctorate in religious studies in 1985. Many of you read his column called Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler that he writes for Spirituality and Health magazine. Rabbi Rami also has a radio program that I know of, called Essential Conversations, that is sponsored by Spirituality and Health magazine. For more information, check out Rabbi Rami's webpage at rabbirami.com. Today, Rabbi Rami will speak on the topic, You Must Be Present to Win. Let's welcome Rabbi Rami.
Good morning. So this is much better. Elevated above all of you. This is, somebody finally got the church thing right. It's very hard to take seriously pastors who stand on the same level as parishioners. You start to wonder if they're making this stuff up. But once they're elevated, you know this is the truth. So I expect you to give me that same credulity. I don't know, anyone seen the New York Times on Friday where, and I've forgotten the author's name, but this woman wrote this amazing article on the ISIS policy of rape as part of their jihad. And it's a legalist document based in their reading of Islam that excuses, that encourages and legitimizes rape of Yazidi women who are captured. And it goes into all these laws about it to make sure it's very, halal. It's really permitted in the Islamic tradition. And I thought it was, on the one hand, it is horrifying. On the other hand, it is an honest reflection of the dark side of religion. They didn't just say, hey, we can do what we want. They said, we are under the law of Allah. And this is what Allah wants. Now, you can talk to some other Muslims and they'll tell you that's crazy. But that's not the point. I'm not saying this is Islam. I'm saying that religion, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, it's whatever it is, can be read in any way that people want to read it in order to hide behind it to do what they want to do. Right? So our topic is, you have to be present to win. You have to come out of hiding. And one of the major places we hide is in religion. So just so you don't think I'm just bashing ISIS, not that I would defend ISIS, but just in case. There was the recent case in Israel of the ultra-Orthodox, maybe we shouldn't even say ultra anymore, maybe just the Orthodox Jews who firebombed that family's house and the little 18-month-old toddler was killed there, and they did that in the name of their God. I mean, they didn't just say, hey, it's okay to firebomb houses. No, they said, it's okay to firebomb Palestinian houses because our God says that it's kosher. Similarly, the guy who was arrested, he was released after five years for stabbing gay people, and then he got out and went right to Walmart, or wherever they go in Israel, and he bought a knife and went out and stabbed another gay person. I think that person has died, if I'm not mistaken. Is that true? Did she die? So she was 16 years old, and he stabbed her. Now, he didn't stab her simply because he likes stabbing people. He stabbed her because she was in support. Maybe she was gay, I have no idea. But she was marching in support of gay pride, gay rights, gay liberation. And that offended his God, and therefore his God said to him, anyway, you can kill her. I mean, this is stuff that goes back thousands of years. Abraham, God said to Abraham, to quote Bob Dylan as opposed to the Bible, so Roger doesn't get too apoplectic, but God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, God, are you putting me on? God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but the next time you see me, you better run. And then it goes on to Highway 61. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But you get the idea that God threatens Abraham. If you don't do what I say, no matter how vile what I say is, you're going to be in trouble. Now, where does this stuff come from? So you can say, if you're a traditional believer, that it's part of God's plan. God is up here somewhere, and God finds Abraham and tells Abraham what to do. Or you can say religion is a product of human imagination, and Abe, why he would want to kill Isaac, I don't know, but somewhere, well, maybe I do, but somewhere, you know, in his mind, he had some violent streak in him that he wanted to kill his son, and he heard what he wanted to hear, right? He heard what he wanted to hear. And that's what happens with religion. We always hear what we want to hear. Otherwise, we change religions, and we keep changing religions until we find what we want to hear. We're not looking for truth. We're looking for someone to corroborate our opinion. And it's in our opinions that we hide. So the first thing, I'm going to stick with the Bible in this talk. The first thing that God says, the first conversation God has with humans, the first thing God says to humans is be fruitful and multiply. But the first conversation God has with humans is what? What does God say? Anybody know? Of course. No, those are commands. Yeah, he does say that. But the conversation, the first time when God says, you know, says something and he expects a response, and then you go back and forth. The first conversation is after they've eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. God says to them, you know, God, according to the story, God is walking in the garden in the cool of the day, because even God doesn't like summer. Why would he create it? You know, if it's too hot, why make it? But okay, anyway. So that's just another theological problem. But according to the story, God is walking in the garden, and he's looking for Adam, and there's no Eve yet. She's not named yet, but looking for the man and the woman. And he says, Echa, where are you? And then the guy says, I was hiding. Adam steps out of hiding and says, I was hiding because I was I was naked and I was ashamed. And you know, they'd already been naked. I mean, they were always naked. When they were created, they were naked, and they were not ashamed. And then the next time he says he's naked, he is ashamed. So you have to figure there was a long time span between those two moments. In the Bible, it's one day. But, he was made like sort of Michelangelo looking, healthy. They were both healthy people. By the time they were ashamed of their bodies, decades must have gone by, when they were... They weren't eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, but they're eating at Dunkin' Donuts every day. So anyway, so they were ashamed, they were hiding. So you have to figure, if you believe the Bible is a human document, which I do, you have to figure that the author has something in mind besides telling a story. Even just the story we heard, the African tale about the mosquito, it's called a teleological story. It explains why we slap mosquitoes, right? And that's why, because they deserve it, right? And that's basically, I don't know why that's a Unitarian message, but, clearly Unitarians have their enemy too. It's mosquitoes, and we justify their destruction. So, fine. But that explains why we kill mosquitoes. Okay, so there's always something behind in the mind of the author when they create these kinds of things. So what was in the mind of the author who created the conversation, this first conversation with God? Where are you? And then they come out of hiding. Harold Bloom is one of the major Bible scholars of the early 21st century, retired professor from Yale. He argues that these stories were written by women in King David's court. The women were the literati of their time. They were the intellectuals, the thinkers, the artists, and they wrote these stories as critiques of their world. And a lot of them were critiques of men. I mean, the men in the Genesis stories written by these women are usually doofuses, and it's the women who move the story along, even though the men are the character in the forefront, given the sociology of patriarchy. It was stories by women making fun of men. And you can see that in the Adam and Eve story too. But in this case, the theory is, or the speculation is, that the author of the story, whatever her name was, is trying to say that when you are in contact with the divine, however you define it, when you're in contact with the divine, the initial experience is one of being called out of hiding. Right? The initial experience is being called out of hiding, which suggests that we're always hiding in our egoic selves, in our, you know, our own constructs. But that when you meet reality with a capital R, truth with a capital T, God with a capital G, if you like to see them all the same. But when you meet reality with a capital R, what you're called to do is to step out of wherever it is you're hiding and step into reality as it is, regardless of what you want it to be. Does that make sense? You follow that idea? To come out of hiding. That's why the first question that God asks in the story is, where are you? It's not that God doesn't know. I mean, the character of God in the story is all-knowing. So God isn't asking for information. It's a koan, you know, to take mixed religious metaphors here. It's the koan tradition of the Zen Buddhists, where the questions that the master asks are not for the master's... it's not to gather information. It's for the student to step out of hiding, to awake, to become present. So this is one of those instances where God calls us and says, where are you? Not because God doesn't know, but because we are so comfortable in the places we hide that we don't even know we're hiding. So the big question that the Bible opens with is not just in the story, you know, where's Adam and Eve? It's to us, if these women are writing text for the society at large, and we're still reading them, the question is asked of us, where are we hiding? Martin Buber, who is one of my favorite philosophers, in his little book, I only like little books. I write bigger books, but I only read little books. Anyway, in this wonderful little book called The Way of Man, According to the Teaching of Hasidism, it was written in the 50s or published in the 50s. So you have to give Buber a little leeway in his languaging because it's purely patriarchal. But this is what he says about that. He says, where are you? In so asking, God does not expect to learn something. What God wants is to produce an effect in us, which can only be produced by just such a question. Provided that it actually speaks to you. I mean, if you just blow it off, nothing happens. But if you actually hear life calling and asking you, where are you? And you stop and decide to see, oh, I'm hiding. And you step out of hiding. That's what he's talking about. Adam hides to avoid rendering accounts, to escape responsibility for his way of living. So that's what the ISIS people were doing. These are young men driven to by an extreme ideology that is, I mean, patriarchal, doesn't even come close to the amount of misogyny that's in their understanding of Islam. And rape is just natural to them, but they know it's wrong. Somewhere inside themselves, they know it's wrong. And so they have God tell them it's okay. So that's how they're hiding. They're avoiding rendering accounts for their behavior by saying, no, God says this is okay. In a book called The Instructions of the King. It was written a few years ago in Israel by these Orthodox rabbis, and it actually promotes the killing of the indiscriminate killing of Palestinians, even Palestinian babies, under a legal rubric in Judaism called Rodef. Rodef is Hebrew word for pursuer, and the law is, if we're sitting here and we see someone running away from being pursued by someone else to do them harm, we can't just sit here and call 911. We have to get out and stop the pursuer. I mean, it's a social activist kind of thing. And you can imagine it environmentally, and even there's zillions of ways to read the idea. But the idea is, like the Bible says, you cannot stand idly by while another bleeds. So you see someone pursued, you have to go out and stop the pursuer. And according to the rules, if the pursuer is trying to kill the other person, you can even stop the pursuer by killing the pursuer. So the authors of this book, the Instructions of the King, took that idea and said, all Jews are pursued by non-Jews. All non-Jews want to do harm to Jews. Therefore, all non-Jews are Rodef, and we can kill them to stop the pursuit. And then they get specific about Palestinians. All Palestinians are trying to destroy Israelis and Jews in general. So we have an obligation, a legal obligation, to stop them, even if that means killing little children. And that's how they justify the atrocities they would like that happen, and they would like to see not just continue to happen, but to expand in the Middle East. They just couldn't say, I hate these people, let's just commit genocide. They couldn't do that. So they came up with a rule that comes from God in their imagination and twisted it to kill babies, which was not the intent of the rule. The rule is clear. It's what I said to you. It's not about, you know, imagining pursuers and then slaughtering them without consequence. But that's what we do, and we hide behind these systems of thought. So Buber says, we hide to avoid rendering account, to escape responsibility for our way of living. Every person hides for this purpose. For every person is Adam and finds him or herself in Adam's situation. To escape responsibility for our lives, we turn existence into a system of hideouts. I just love that line. We turn existence into a system of hideouts. So if this doesn't speak to you, then you can just mentally twiddle your thumbs and wait till I'm done. But if it does speak to you, then you should be hearing the question, Echa, where am I? No, where are you? But where, you know, asking yourself, where am I? How am I turning my life into a system of hideouts? How am I avoiding the challenge of being a decent, just, holy being in the world by the ideas I hide behind the philosophies, politics, religion, whatever it happens to be? Where am I hiding from being the kind of human I know that we humans could be? So to escape from responsibility, we turn existence into a system of hideouts, and it is thus hiding again and again from the face of God, he says, that we enmesh ourselves more and more deeply in perversity. A new situation arises which becomes more and more questionable with every day, with every new hideout. This situation can be precisely defined as follows. We cannot escape the eye of God, but in trying to hide from God, we are hiding from ourselves. True, in ourselves too, there is something that seeks us, but we make it harder and harder for that something to find us. This question, where are you, is designed to awaken you and destroy your system of hideouts. It's to show you that what passes for your normal life is in fact a way to escape authentic living. So I don't know. I don't know if that speaks to you or not, but it absolutely speaks to me. I can look at my life and see dozens of places where I'm hiding, where I've got some ideas that basically excuse the way I want to live. And I'm clinging to those so that I can do what I want to do. But there's no reason other than my own predilection. There's no reason to believe that what I believe is true. It just suits me. And it suits me because it feeds my systems of hideouts. The way out, from the Bible's point of view, is to be asked, you know, where are you? The Buddhists have another way. So I want to teach you this other way. And they call it, and I say they, it's actually from a specific Zen master whose name escapes me. But it's called only don't know. Only don't know. And that's what this Zen master kept saying. Whatever the student would come and say, what do I do about this? And the master would just say, only don't know. If you lived a life of not knowing, you would get up every morning completely curious about what's next, because you wouldn't know. You know, you wouldn't assume that this is what's going to happen, and then when it doesn't happen, that something is wrong, because you had no assumption of what was right. So whatever happens is simply what happens, and you don't know why it happens. And if you don't know why it happens, you don't have to worry about why it happens. You don't have to go into a whole long, discursive exploration for the to answer the question why. You simply have to deal with what it is at the moment that it is. Why is one of the hideouts that we create for ourselves when we say, well, why is this going on? If you've ever been in therapy, I don't know if any of you have been in therapy, but I've put a few therapists through, I bought a few yachts for a few therapists. And the magic question that therapists always ask is, well, why? Because there's no end to that. You know? Well, I really never got along with my dad. Why? Or as opposed to, well, what could you do differently to be a better, you know, have a better relationship? Now, why do you think that is? Oh, well, because when I was 6 years old, you know, he blah, blah, blah. Why do you think he did that? You know, I bet when he was a kid, and why was that? Well, my grandfather, and you just go back and back until you get back to the earliest memories that you've got, and then you still ask why, and then they invent past life therapy so that you can say, oh, because in a previous life, there's no end to the why. The why is just another place to hide out and keep us from actually engaging life, even when life is painful. It doesn't matter why X is happening. What matters is, what do I do with it? I don't even know. I mean, I carefully said, what do I do with it, as opposed to what do I do about it? I think there's a difference. What do I do with it? About it sounds like I'm separate from it, but I'm never separate from anything that happens, because nothing happens to me, because I'm part of the whole thing. So everything happens with me. So what do I do with what's happening? That's the question. But you can't face what's happening if you're still in hiding. So the first thing you have to do is come out of hiding. Now, bear with me a couple minutes more. We'll go through this more personally later. But Buber then goes on from that. And he says, when you step out of hiding, you discover that you're absolutely unique. So Adam and Eve in the story are the first people on the planet. So they're totally unique. No one's ever, met humans before. And according to the book God, A Biography by Jack Miles, God had never met humans before either and is totally shocked that they're so anarchic and rambunctious, and they never do what they're told, and that's why he gets disgusted and drowns them all in Noah, and then he feels bad, he misses them, so he makes some more of them. But in God, A Biography, God is like as stunned with these beings as you and I might be stunned when we see how crazy humans can be. But according to Buber, so these are the first people, and therefore they represent us. And that's why the question, where are you, is not just to them, it's to us. And then he says, when you come out of hiding, you discover this amazing thing. You discover that each person born into this world represents something new. So it's not just Adam and Eve who were new, but you and I are absolutely new. Each person born into this world represents something new, something that never existed before, something original and unique. I mean, that is an amazing thing, which you don't get if you're hiding. Because if you're in hiding, you're part of a group, behavior, whatever it is. I'm glad you're having a good first week at high school. That's really great. And, if you have teachers like Frank, I have no worries. But a lot of what you learn in high school is how not to be you. It's about how to fit in, the people who stand out are the people who get punched down, right? So Buber is saying that's a terrible thing that happens to us. But when you step out of hiding, and one of the places we hide is in conformity, right? So you step out of that, and you discover that you are absolutely unique in the world. I mean, that's a shocking thing. You are original and unique. No one has ever been me before. Even if you believe in past lives, you were never you before. You were somebody else before. Right? I mean, I used to be King David, Cleopatra, Shakespeare. I'm still trying to collect royalties, but nobody seems to buy that line. But I mean, because no one is ever Shakespeare's chambermaid. No one ever said, yeah, I was one of those guys who carried Cleopatra on his shoulders. I mean, no one's that. I was always the king or the queen. Because we're too egotistical, too narcissistic to have past lives that weren't really cool. But when you think about it, even if you were Cleopatra, you're not Cleopatra now. Now you're someone else, totally new and unique. It is the duty of every person to know and consider that she is unique in the world in her particular character, and that there has never been anyone like, I'm changing it, trying to get this a little less sexist, like you in the world. For if there had been someone like you, there would have been no need for you to be in the world, right? The world is not, doesn't repeat. It's not redundant. You are not redundant. You're absolutely unique. The world has never done you before. Every single person is a new thing in the world and is called upon to fulfill his or her particularity in the world. For this, and because this is not done, the messianic age is delayed. Everyone's foremost task in the world is to actualize, or your foremost task in the world is to actualize your unique, unprecedented, and never recurring potentialities, and not the repetition of something another, be it even the greatest, has achieved already. Right? Let me just read the first part. Your foremost task is the articulation of your unique, unprecedented, and never recurring potentiality in the world. Whoever tells you that, right? That's not how I was raised. I mean, I was taught to fit in. My parents had an ideal of what I was supposed to be, and you were in it, and if you stepped out of it, poof, they slammed you back in it. And then I left my parents and I went to, you know, college, and they had an idea of what you were supposed to be, and as long as you stayed in it, you did fine. And if you stepped out of it, bam, they slapped you back in it. And then you get a job and you want to fit in. And if you don't, you want to excel or whatever it is, but if you don't fit in the box, bam, they slap you in it or they kick you out. You go find another box. There's no end to people who are trying to get us to conform to their systems. Buber is saying there is no system to which you must conform. The only thing to which you must conform is your own unique, never before manifested potentiality. What is that? You know, where are you is the first question. When you step out of hiding, you realize you've never been before. I don't know if that blows you away. It absolutely blows my mind every time I think about it. This incredibly vast universe of tens of millions of galaxies has never Ramied before. I mean, that's amazing. Now, if I was the only one that was unique, you know, then the stage would have to be much higher. But since we're all unique, we're all that, we should be walking around going, wow, Monica-ing. How cool is that? That's never happened before. How can I be rude or take advantage of someone who is something that is absolutely unique in the cosmos? All I can really do is go, wow, how amazing to meet that manifestation. So you come out of hiding, and then you realize the uniqueness of yourself and everyone else. And then comes the hardest question, I think, of all, which is, so how do I actualize those potentialities? How do I even know what they are? And there is no answer for that. Bible doesn't tell you, Quran doesn't tell you, religion doesn't tell you. They tell you just the opposite. Oh, no, you're here to do X. We'll tell you what to do. But once you realize you're here to be yourself, and no one's ever been that before, there's no roadmap. There's no instruction manual. There's just, whoa, who am I? What do I do with this situation I'm in? And then life becomes a complete experiment. No, or an adventure, maybe. Or, you know, however you want to define it, but something that's totally open-ended and without fixed guidelines about what to do. I think that when you experience your own uniqueness and the uniqueness of someone else, morality, like the Taoists will say, when people are moral, goodness goes out the window. Because morality is a system behind which we hide. It's moral if I believe X to burn a Palestinian toddler. It's moral if I believe Y to rape Yazidi women. But if I don't have that, if I just know that that toddler is an absolutely unique, never before created manifestation of the universe, how can I do anything but, oh, little baby, so cute. You know, I can't harm it. Love is all that's left when you realize your uniqueness. Which is why I think people don't want us to realize it. I think that the societies don't want us to realize what Buber is talking about, because if we do, the societal norms break down and all you have left is authentic love, and that scares societies to death, which is why they're always trying to legislate who you can love and all that. So here's the message, if you haven't figured out what I'm talking about yet. Whether you're taking it from the Bible or you're taking it from, you know, Only Don't Know from the Buddhist tradition, or wherever you want to take it from, or just from no place other than your own experience, reality calls us out of hiding and says, Where are you? And if we step out, we discover our uniqueness. And if we discover our uniqueness, we discover that we are all love and compassion. And when we discover that, then we might know. I don't know. I've never done it. But then we might know what to do with this situation. And never have to worry if we're doing it wrong, because it's all love from all sides. So I'm going to stop with that. And we'll come back and talk back and try to figure out what the hell I was trying to say. Thank you.